Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hello and welcome. My name is Fauna Foreman, and I co-direct the new UCSD Center on Global Justice. And along with Jerry Mackey, I'd like to welcome you all and to welcome Richard Sennett to UCSD. Now, I'm not sure Richard realizes it, but his visit has instigated a new project here at UCSD that we're calling the Urban Ecologies of Global Justice. It's a collaboration between the Center on Global Justice, Teddy Cruz's new Center on Urban Ecologies, and Keith Pizzoli in the Urban Studies Program. Our thanks tonight to Steve Erie, Director of Urban Studies, to John Evans, Chair of Sociology, for their support, and our thanks as well to Associate Vice Chancellor Mary Walshock for helping to arrange UCTV coverage. Again, this all sounds like a careful and deliberate plan, but in fact, it happened rather quickly and serendipitously, what Teddy would call Tijuana style. Where's Teddy? Tijuana style. A few weeks ago, Richard told me he was going to be in LA and that he'd love to come down and see the border and see some interesting communities and hang out a bit. And when I floated the idea with Teddy, he lit up, as Teddy does. And it struck us both immediately that Richard's work represented a magnificent convergence between the local and the global, and thus a bridge between Teddy's work on urban ecologies and mine and Jerry's work on global justice. So we immediately called Keith Pizzoli, who has an interest in these things, and a collaboration was born. Well, tonight we're delighted to welcome, in a slightly less funky space, our muse, Richard Sennett, who will talk about his new book on cooperation, Together, the Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. Just a few words about Richard before I set him loose. For more than 40 years, Richard has been writing about the everyday, about how we experience the cities we inhabit, the labor we do, the culture that we both absorb and make. His dozen or so books have tended to cluster around these themes and are typically intersections of them all. Richard's field, I suppose, is sociology, but his ideas and his insights flow like literature, elegantly, playfully, ethnographically rich, across the disciplines of architecture, design, music, art, literature, history, philosophy, political, and economic theory. Richard's urban sensibility runs through everything that he does, a sort of Socrates who loves the city. And he has written several books on the relation between people and the built environment of the city. He's probably best known for two themes that run through most of his work. First is the decline of public space, described most famously in The Fall of Public Man of 1977, in which Richard argued that countercultural narcissism and a kind of preoccupation with personal narrative and history had destroyed our sense of connection with one another. And second, his analysis of the evolving nature of work in modern capitalism and how we have lost mastery over our own lives, a project exemplified in the Hidden Injuries of Class of 1972 and carried on in various ways in the Culture of the New Capitalism of 1996 and in the Corrosion of Character of 1998. More recently, Richard has turned to the subject of Homo Faber, borrowing from Hannah Arendt, the making of culture, of which his newest works, The Craftsman and Together, the book we're discussing tonight, are a part. Richard has held academic posts at Yale, New York University, MIT, and the London School of Economics. He was the founding director of the New York Institute of the Humanities, which promotes collaboration across sectors in and with New York City. He is presently University Professor of the Humanities at New York University and chairs the advisory board of the Cities Program at the London School of Economics. Now, Teddy and I spent this sunny San Diego afternoon with Richard, walking around sites and through parts of the city that we thought he would find interesting, from the Salk Institute, whose magisterial elegance I think he genuinely was moved by, to the Tijuana Estuary, with Homeland Security sort of stationed overhead and buzzing around in helicopters above us, to San Ysidro, where we stood within spitting distance of the border wall in the parking lot of the Las Americas Mall. Teddy narrated, I drove, Richard absorbed. And as I watched Richard notice what he did, I too began to recognize the ambiguities, the mixtures, separations, boundaries, and porosity of the built environment that I inhabit. I began to see with him, as one inevitably does when reading his books, but seeing together with him in real time, in a shared space, was an entirely novel experience. So let's go for a walk tonight with Richard Sennett as he discusses his new book, Together, The Rituals, Pleasures, and Politics of Cooperation. Will you please welcome him?
I have to say, this was an absolutely astounding walk to me, to see this border fence and in front of it a, what was it? Was it Gucci? Yeah. It's incredible. So you really live in a kind of fantasy landscape of here. I'm very grateful to you for taking me around. I'm not going to be able to give you a summary of this book, which is cheap, and you'll want to take it home to bed with you and things like that. But I do want to talk about one theme in it, which relates to practical work in planning and community development. And that's what difference it means to talk about and to understand cooperation as something that's a skill and how we develop that skill. I'm going to try and give you some thoughts of my own about what it means to become skillful at cooperating with other people. And then I'd like to talk to you a little about why this matters to us when we're doing work from the bottom up in planning and urban design, where we need to cooperate with local residents and local communities. This is a very large subject. I mean, and I'm narrowing it down. At its largest, the United States is obviously, to all of you, suffering a crisis of cooperation in the political sphere. And I would say more largely in capitalism today, that forms of cooperation that sustained workers in the past are being steadily eroded, so that the experience of becoming skilled in cooperating with other workers and translating that experience of cooperation into fraternal action is becoming very weakened. And it's that large subject that I try and address in my book. Let me start but as I say, I want to talk more, as it were, in the family about what cooperation means to us as people who are working in cities, and particularly in with local communities. Let me start by talking a little about how we can understand what cooperation is. There's a very simple definition that you can use, which is that cooperation is working with others to do things you can't do for yourself. And that is an experience that begins at the very onset of human life. Infants need to cooperate with their parents for food, to understand the world at large, and so on. That's natural cooperation. And the trajectory that happens in development of human beings is that they learn how, from that almost instinctive cooperation, to deal with very complex forms of cooperation, or can learn a difficult cooperation, which is working with people you don't understand, you don't like, or you don't know. So this moves from something that is an experience we all have to at its most complex, dealing with strangers or antagonists. And how one develops that capacity to deal with difficult cooperation, I treat as a craft. And that's why this book is related to the earlier book that I did on craftsmanship. I'm trying in this book to understand if there are some aspects of skill development that we have in dealing with the material world that translate into our skills in dealing with one another. I just want to say two things about this journey, this developmental journey, and I talk about it at much greater length in the book. The first is that around the time that young human beings reach the end of their fourth or their fifth year, that there comes to be a challenge to this kind of natural cooperation, and it is that cooperation seems now to be an antithetical to the dawning human sense of autonomy. That is, that for the baby, and for the baby's parents, cooperation is usually a win-win situation. The baby gets something, the parents get something from being able to work with their children. What we know from work by Sarah Hardy, H-R-D-Y, this is a new book on cooperation among children out, is that at this, something happens around the age of five, so that cooperation seems to go into a kind of, also to be experienced as a zero-sum game. That what people, when people cooperate with each other, that they lose something in themselves. And many psychologists have argued that what's actually happening here is that this zero-sum game is the beginning of developing a sense of personal autonomy, that there's something in oneself which can't be given to other people. That's one way to look at it. The second thing I want to say, but there is a problem. It's very well documented in child studies. At a certain point, cooperation ceases to be as innocent as it is for the child. The second issue that I want you to take on board is something we frequently, or not we, but many writers on cooperation frequently create as an opposition. That is the relation between cooperation and competition, arguing that these are fundamental antinomies, that they're opposed to each other. And it's a puzzle to me that this argument could ever be made by anybody who's played a team sport in which cooperation, working with others, and competing against them combines. I don't mean just that you cooperate with your teammates in order to compete against somebody else, but that in playing a game, you have to also cooperate with those you're going to compete against in order to establish the ground rules. You need a set of rituals and conventions which allow you to compete with each other. It's a very kind of cliched understanding of cooperation that looks at it as sort of very soft, whereas that competition is something that's much stronger, tougher with people. And in fact, as in sports, so in markets and other forms of economic activity, there is something which is a delicate adjustment between cooperating with and competing against other human beings that structures social relations. So you want to get that cliche out of your mind. I knew this from the military as well, that if you treated cooperation and competition as opposites, you are likely to die in battle. So, anyhow, that's another story. And the final thing I want to say about this, which takes me into the subject of skill, is why I use the word pleasure in this book about talking about difficult cooperation. I use it in a very deep, about a very deep sense of pleasure, which is sometimes called ego strength. That is, the pleasure in believing that you are and in being able to manage difficult circumstances with other people, which is, for Eric Erickson and other psychoanalysts, the essence of what we think of as an ego strength. It's not self-assertion. It's not submission. It's the management of complicated situations that require knowledge of others, behavior of oneself, and so on, that keeps one capable of dealing with complexity. And that is people who have the confidence that they can deal with difficult situations with other people experience pleasure in its most profound sense. But to experience that pleasure, they have to be able to become skillful in their social relations. And I want to describe to you, by pairs of opposites, three forms of skillful cooperation, three dimensions in which the skill of cooperation takes form. And this sounds all very abstract, but I'll make it as simple as I can. The first is the way in which cooperation develops along the vector between dialectics and dialogics. The second is the way cooperation develops along the vector between formal and informal activity. And the third is the way cooperation develops along the vector between empathy and sympathy. And I'm going to try and describe each one of these to you in fairly concrete terms. We can understand the difference between dialectics and dialogics is the difference between being able to assert something, to express a view, and becoming skilled in doing so, and which is dialectical, and what we think of as listening skills, which are dialogical. The first is about presenting something expressively to somebody else in a particular form, and the second is about being able to take in what you hear from others. And in my book, I have focused mostly on dialogical skills, on skills of listening, because I think these are absolutely key for doing practical work in communities. Let me just say a little more about this difference. I'm sure you didn't get this here, but if you were badly taught about dialectic, you were taught that it consists of a thesis, an antithesis, and a synthesis. That is, an assertion, a counter-assertion, and then everything coming together. This very rarely happens, and it's very rarely the way in which people speak to or even argue with each other. And it certainly is not the way in which Hegel thought about dialectic. For Hegel, this is a power relationship. The assertiveness, the thesis, is something that a master presents to a slave, as in the form, like, you're not working hard enough, or you can do better. And for Hegel, the notion of an antithetical response to that is actually a displacement, which is to talk about something else, like, isn't this an interesting project? You know? And the synthesis is a way in which people learn that it's a self-defensive thing that the slave, by which he means the subordinate, changes the subject. It's a way of defending an accusation or an assertion of control. And the synthesis is not so much putting everything together, but a recognition of what each other is saying. My friend Jim Scott has written a wonderful book called Hidden Transcripts, which is an attempt to look at this Hegelian idea in the dialogue between real slaves and real masters, both in Brazil and in Indonesia, about how there is a kind of coming together so that people are, in the synthetic thing, understanding that they are speaking back and forth to each other. It's also the idea of Jürgen Habermas about communicative interaction. But what's at the core of it is the notion of back and forth leading to something which is more of an intertwined tissue. And that's the cooperative element, and it contains a lot of tension. It contains a lot of conflict, but there is also a kind of knitting together. In dialogics, there's quite a different situation obtains. The term dialogical comes from a writer named Mikhail Bakhtin, who's a Russian 20th century. I think he was killed by Stalin in 38. I'm not sure of the date. He's a great, great literary and philosophical figure. And by dialogics, he meant two things, which is it's an attempt. Well, he meant many things by it, but as it deals with listening skills, it's first of all an attempt to take in what people mean, which is not what they say. So it's an attempt, as we would say, to look for subtext and to hear what's not spoken. It's what a psychoanalyst or any good shrink wants to do. And secondly, it's an idea that the actual interchanges between people don't have a denouement. That is, you have a talk with somebody, you attend to what they're thinking or feeling, which they're not saying. You respond to that, but you, in the end, don't put it together into something that's a synthesis where you have a denouement, a sense of better understanding of each other. Bakhtin called this stranger knowledge, and you can understand what he means if you think about, most of you probably had the experience I've had of talking to a stranger in a bar or on an airplane, although less on an airplane because you're about to die and you don't really want to talk to anybody in an airplane. But, you know, you have an encounter with a stranger. You're never going to see them again. Something in casually talking to them spurs something in you, or something you say to them spurs something in them there's a kind of new awareness of an issue, but it's not necessarily vocalized between the two of you. It's like, you know, balls bouncing off of each other. And Bakhtin's idea is that this is what stranger knowledge is about, and that it takes skill to be able to attend to those clues that are uncovering what's hidden beneath the surface of talk. And my argument to you is that when we do work in communities, it's hearing what's not been said, what people can't vocalize, what they actually are, what they mean to say, even if they say the opposite, which is something that we need to develop in order to be able to have a productive relationship in community development or in local organizing. It's the difference, if you like, between presenting something to somebody where we can say at the end, great, we know where we are, right? We agree on X, which is dialectical, or we can understand each other. And the sense that we've gotten something from other people, but we don't quite, we're not able to quite define what it is. So it's very, it's learning how to dwell in ambiguity. So that's one kind of collaborative skill in terms of speech acts that I think is important for us. The second skill, and I've tried in my book to show how this develops, is between what can be called informal and formalized conditions of cooperating with each other. And I'm going to stick to the speech level for the moment on this. At the speech level, formal speech is declarative. I think informal speech is what I call subjunctively organized. It seems to me that it might be possible, or don't you think that, which is a kind of subjunctive mood. Why is this a difference between the formal and the informal? Because when you're declarative, what you do is face somebody else with a fixed meaning to which they have to respond. Whereas when you're in the subjunctive mood, you're leaving a space in between where the other doesn't need immediately to respond to a provocation. And my argument in the book is that this kind of formalizes, that is, the conditions between two people. There isn't a definition of what's going on. My argument in the book is that learning how to speak in the subjunctive is a way of creating a space of freedom in dealing with situations with other people. My old friend Bernard Williams, who's a philosopher in Cambridge, once, this is not a blindingly original insight of mine, once spoke about the fetish of assertion in talking about what he hated about American culture. And his notion was everybody is upfront. They tell you exactly, you know, they're in your face. And he said what that does is really it destroys the freedom of conversation, because all you can do is if I say, you know, bloody Obama, what a bastard, you've got to, you know, you're in a very competitive situation. It's a challenging situation. Whereas Bernard's way of doing this would have been very, very impressive. A very impressive person. But I wonder if perhaps also, wouldn't you think perhaps a little weak? Which invites the other to, you know, lay out different kinds of responses. It's obvious that this distinction between the declarative and the subjunctive has something to do with dialogics and dialectics. In when we have a debate with somebody, we are declarative. When Americans have debates with people. Whereas the notion of dealing in the subjunctive, not being assertive, making things conditional, uncertain, invites other people to a more dialogical kind of response to us. In my book, I try and show how that skill, and this is, it's a rabbit hole I don't want to jump down, between the declarative and the subjunctive, has a lot to do with how people learn to deal with physical objects in craft work. When you encounter resistance as a craftsman, the last thing you want to do is try and hammer that nail or use maximum force to try and erase the obstacle. You want to work with minimum resistance in order to work effectively. And that has a reflection in what I'm describing to you now. That is, that the assertion of minimum force is an invitation to work with the object rather than to try and knock it out. I'll just give you another example of this. I studied to be a musician when I was young, and what we had to learn is that when we encountered something that was hard, like I'm a cellist playing way up on the fingerboard, that the more effort you make to make a sound, the less good the sound is going to be. You have to surrender a bit to it. You can't fight against an obstacle in order to ultimately be able to make a sound. It's true for carpenters. It's true for glass blowers. It's a basic principle of craft. And it, I think, transfers over into the realm of working with other people in the same way that it does in working with material things. The third element of this kind of craft of cooperation that I think is important has to do with the awareness of the positive awareness of the other. And this can take two forms. One is sympathy, and the other is empathy. Sympathy is a way of becoming aware of other people's needs by identifying with them. Our friend Adam Smith, Theory of Moral Sentiments, says, you know, if I see somebody fall or injure themselves, I put myself in their place. I imagine what their pain is my pain, and I reach out to help them. Sympathy is always based on identification. Empathy is quite a different experience. That is, I mean, another form of sympathy very familiar to me was Clinton's I Feel Your Pain, you know, which used to drive me crazy. I am going to just drop down this rabbit hole. He felt it about, he literally, I know him, and he is somebody capable of identifying with anybody. There's something also egomaniacal about that, which is there's no experience that you have that I can't identify with, i.e., there's no experience you have that I can't understand. And when confronted with this observation, his response is, don't be a professor. But you understand the point of this. I feel your pain means I'm also capable of understanding who you are. Nothing is foreign to me. And that's the problem with sympathy. Empathy is something else. Empathy is attention to somebody or to something that you don't understand, that you can't identify with. And the most concrete example of that occurs in science and scientific work. You come up with something that's a strange result, and you're curious about it. Rather than saying, I can't make any sense of this, or if you wanted to put this out to the ethical framework, I can identify with what's going on here. I feel I understand it. See what the problems are. Somebody else in a laboratory. In a scientific experiment, when things go wrong and your curiosity is provoked by something you don't understand, you have what, again, psychologists like Jerome Bruler think of as cognitive empathy. You're curious about something which is foreign to you without claiming that you can identify with it. And my argument is, again, for us as people dealing with communities, particularly communities of poor people, that sympathy serves us much more poorly than does empathy. That the ability to be curious about people whom you may find, in fact, quite antipathetic, but you're still curious about them, is a way of establishing groundwork for working together, which is, I think, much stronger than the attempt to say, God, I know what you're feeling, you poor thing, you know, I get it all, which in a way is leaving somebody else no space. Now, I was going to talk to you, if I'm very long-winded about this subject, and I just scratched the surface, I was going to talk to you about spaces of cooperation, but I'm not going to do that, because I would like to focus a little on the practice of cooperation in doing community work. How does this theory that I've laid out to you, what does it mean in everyday work? You can understand, most of you can, well, maybe you haven't had this experience. When I've hired young, mostly elite community workers from Harvard or Yale or Oxford, they have this immediate notion of trying to get close to the people and trying to be a helping hand for people, the community, to realize its own desires. It seems like an act of modesty, but in fact, often it reads to people in a community like, get off this. What is this person about? This sweet angel coming here to help us out to realize ourselves. It's a very, very bad phenomenon. It's a kind of perversion of sympathy, which is, I'm here to help you. It's a perversion of sympathy that Hannah Arendt, who was my teacher, wrote about when she argued that all acts of sympathy really are condescending. That is, you're feeling pity for people, and you're there to help them because they're suffering, which is a very condescending way to deal with people. So what's the alternative to that? That's a very poor way to establish a mutually respectful basis of cooperation, in other words. One of the things that, if any of you have been involved in design work with local communities, you will know, is that most people, when you say, how would you like your school to look or your community health service to look, fall back on the most conservative visual language they have. And this is, we've seen this in housing at the LSE, where we've done a lot of community-developed housing. When we ask people, what would you like to build? They recur to Victorian gimcrack, buildings. Awful. And they do so for a very particular reason, which is that that's what they know, that's familiar in their environment. And when, particularly when we're doing work that involves a visual design, we've got to somehow figure out how we can cooperate with them without becoming prisoner of what's familiar to them. And I'll tell you what the strategy, that sort of technique, I guess you can call it, that we've developed over the last decade, maybe useful to you, maybe not, but it's a way of trying to enable the fact that we do have skills as designers, and they don't, and yet to create a cooperative situation. I'll tell you what we do. As in a housing project that we're involved in now in Glasgow with the local community, we bring in three or four alternative models of what could be done for the budget that the community has for a particular site. And these are realized models. And the idea is to say to people, this is possible for the cash that you've got in hand, and it serves these designs meet planning regulations. And now you've got to decide what you want. And the first impulse of people to say is, what's best? And the last thing in the world you can say is they're all equally good, which is another way of saying, what do I know? I'm just, you know, here. It's all up to you, and so on. It's disempowering in the name of being self-defeating. So what we've done is taken advocates for each design, people in our shop, who will explain why they think their design is the best. And that's sort of stage one of how we do this work, and they make an argument. The second stage is to convert all of that from dialectics and assertion into dialogics. And the idea is we ask people, look, here are these are the arguments for this. Let's work it through. Who do you believe? The people who made the arguments are finished. We have to make a decision. You have to make a decision. Let's work it through. And what we found when this works, and of course sometimes it's a spectacular failure. I'm not saying this is a magic bullet. We've had disasters. But when it does work, what happens is that gradually people start talking to each other. They speak more subjunctively. They're more interested. They get curious about relation between three seemingly contrary designs. And in the end, the choice is usually not one over the other, but something that's a kind of mixture of good elements that they've arrived at. And this is a method that we've used. We've done it for housing. We've done it for vest pocket parks and so on. And this is, it's a strategy, if you like, for not for the expert or the person with skill, not suppressing his or her own skill, but bringing somebody else into a collaborative working relationship where you're honest to yourself and they know that you're being honest with them, and that gradually they'll take over. And that's the method. We build models. We never do things online, you know, in CAD to people. We always make physical things people walk around with. The more tactile, the better. And usually out of styrofoam, which is an environmentally unfriendly material, but it's a great thing for somebody to pick up a block of it and say, what if we stick this here? So for me, this has been, this last 10 years, a way of finding a method of working as an urban designer, which has a kind of theoretical grounding, the grounding that I've laid out to you tonight. As I say, it's not a magic bullet. It can frequently fail. And it's got a big constraint around it, which is that what I've described to you like this works great at the micro level, but is not a macro strategy, obviously. You can't resist City Hall by having charrettes of this kind. It's not, and you know, I'm so old that I just follow my own bent. I like working on local things. I like things that are concrete. And this is a way of accomplishing something that, if the conditions are right, so that people are able to do community development on their own, it's a way of creating, I would say, a kind of dialogical community urban design. And it seems to, the greatest successes we've had with this, we do a lot of vest pocket parks. And that's something that's sort of easy for people to take on board because it's kind of blank slate. You know, you're recovering abandoned space and recolonizing it, and it works well. It also works well for housing. So I just wanted to give you an idea of, for me, I actually came to this practice, this kind of practice, by thinking theoretically about, this is not inductive for me. That is, I started by thinking about the theory of cooperation, and I arrived at, and so did my colleagues, at ways of putting this into practice. I think it's very difficult in community development work to work the other way around, to take the lessons of experience and try and add them up to something which is a form of practice. That's also true, believe it or not, in craft labor of a physical sort. We have to have an understanding, a propositional understanding about what we're doing when we're working with sound or when we're working with molten glass before we're able to see the ways in which we're going to be able to work effectively. And I guess I conclude by saying about this that if you read my earlier book, you know I am a pragmatist social philosopher, and pragmatism is supposed to be an inductive method of learning by doing, and it's very easy to characterize. You know, you learn about the nature of, I don't know, the cell by ripping apart a pillow or something like that. I don't know. But that's a bad notion about pragmatism. What pragmatism is about is asking what. It's not applied theory, but it's once you've begun thinking about what an action, whether it's a physical action or a social action, is about, thinking about how it gets realized as a process with other people. And that is, I think, pragmatism is really a philosophical school about becoming, but it starts with the notion of using your head, thinking about what you're doing before you do it. And that's why I have never described this method as applied planning. Do you understand what I'm saying about this? Applied planning means that you've got a body of data and you apply it to a particular situation. For us, what we want to know is how social relations work and then try and realize them in the process of actually working with concrete instances. So there's a lot more to say about this. I'm hoping somebody will ask me whether President Obama is good at cooperation, which will take us into a totally... I have a view on that subject, and I'd be curious about yours. Actually, I'll tell you what my view is as well. President Obama is a genius at dialectical cooperation and an absolute incompetent at dialogical cooperation. He wants everything to be evident, people to put their cards on the table, to be clear with each other and to arrive at something which is a common understanding. And he wants to do this with people who are bent on hurting him. If he were more dialogical, he would, I think, probably understand more about the others, and they would be more disorientated by him. So I guess it's easy to think about this kind of ways of thinking about cooperation is that this is very fluffy and soft and nice and so on. In fact, now I may be all wrong about this. This is already a very informalizing statement. I may be all wrong about this, but it seems to me that the travails of President Obama show us the ways in which more dialogical forms of cooperation are actually strengthening rather than disempowering. So can we have some discussion?
Yes.
I'd like you to reflect for us a little bit forward thinking. You mentioned your perspective is good for the micro, but I'm wondering, with the current economic crisis delivering a real body blow to how we self-identify, I mean, we live in a society where we are what we consume. And if we were to sort of boil down into the simplest binary, if we could, you're juxtaposing we are what we consume to potentially the healthier way. We are how we relate to one another. So my question is, in going forward with the cracks that are evolving and we can't consume the way we thought we could, what kinds of openings does this make for a new kind of identity? How can we collectively move more towards the empathic, informal, and dialogic, taking advantage of this sort of rupture in our capacity to consume? You know?
Such a small question. Well, I thought a lot about this. And I think for this country, much less for Britain, but for this country, this is, it could go one of two directions, because the country has been, there have been the assumption of sort of being top dog about being able to consume has been here for so long. I mean, since the Second World War, with blips up and down, of course, with lots of people who are poor and so on, but the cultural nomos is that you can have what you want. And I think this could go in two directions. I think it could provoke in people what I hear as a subtext with a lot of these very right-wing debates, which is these are good people who are dealing with the fact that life isn't working the way it should be. And it may be, I mean, they're not crazies, a lot of these Tea Party people or these evangelical right. But they're dealing with the fact that something is broken, and it may be that their response, which is to imagine, let's go backward, let's freeze up, let's be punitive, could become a general response for the whole society. I don't mean that we'd become like fascists, but that we might in our own way find that this becomes a normal discourse of America, particularly for young people. The other way would be a little more like what happened to the Japanese, who have had a lost decade. And young people in Japan have become, and they say this about themselves all the time, they've become more cynical about what's possible in life and more embracing of everyday experience and what they have, which doesn't cost. It's quite, that's another road to this, where you just take the capitalist beast as there's nothing can be done about it, and you focus on your immediate and everyday social relations. I find it very admirable. But I think things in the States could, I don't think Britain will have this, because although it's having as bad a recession as the U.S., I think it's culturally not, the notion of being entitled to anything in Britain is not there. But I think in America, there's a kind of very deep sense in the nomos of being entitled to having.
So it could flip either way, you know? And my only thought about this is that rather than demonize people on the right, for this is technically what sociologists call ressentiment, rather than demonize people about it, to understand it, it's a real response to a huge cultural break, and we're living that break right now. I mean, what's clear to me is that economically we're never going to go back to what we knew in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. It's over, you know? It's a question about how adaptable, in the end, American society becomes. You know, Teddy, when we went to, one thing that was going through my head is we were at this Gucci emporium on the edge of this middle frontier. Was whether people would stop going to an emporium like that at a certain point by just saying, I don't need this. You know, I don't need to go load up on this kind of stuff. It was packed with young people. Did you see that? So, you know, I mean, and it could change the physical landscape a lot. Maybe malls won't, because people don't have the credit cards to make malls work. Maybe we'll have a whole different configuration. Or people will take something like the Gucci store, wherever it is, as a kind of cultural entitlement, in which case we'll have more and more ressentiment because they're not going to be able to have it. So I think this is a key moment in American, to me, in American society. And it could flip either. It could become more Japanese, or it could be, as it were, more German. You know? Is that a way? Maybe we should all have a drink on this.
Well, I'll intervene with some empathy here and let Richard go. Join me in thanking
Richard, thank you all
for joining us tonight.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.